Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. We promise to keep you awake and be noisy and all that. I'm Gary McGraw, and that's Brian Chess. And we're here from reality, and we're going to tell you what happens in the real world, which is a little disturbing. So hang in there. But the idea is we're going to try to do some science in this field of software security, which is an interesting thing to try to do. And without further ado, Brian's going to start talking.
Okay, so this first slide is really about ground rules. So we're going to take the following our assumptions. And we're not going to talk about this stuff after this first slide. The fact is, all of the companies in this building software, building security and maturity model study take these as the ground rules too. So if you want to argue about these or debate them, then we can do that at some point after this talk. But I'll say this, that I label this slide with the language of revolutionaries. And I do so because this is still, to some extent, a minority viewpoint, believe it or not. The idea that in order to build a secure piece of software, you've got to build security into that software. And you can't do that by sprinkling some cryptography on it, and you can't do that by building some sort of magic security box that lives in the lower left-hand corner of your software. You've actually got to look at the entire piece of software because security is an emergent property of the system. So, let's see. You can't...
Let's say what you can do.
So these
days, everybody says SDLC, secure SDLC. What does that mean?
So you gotta look at the life cycle. You gotta look at where do you get requirements. How do you go about fulfilling those requirements, and how do you go about verifying those requirements? But you've got to do more than that. We're really talking about not just a secure SDLC, but a secure a security initiative. How do you go from the beginning of introducing security into an organization to the end, which is a result that is one that you like from a security perspective? We assume that you got to look for problems both in the system design as well as the system implementation. That's bugs and flaws are 50-50. Unless you can tell us better, unlike the Android guy from this morning, unless you can tell us better, we're going to assume that about half your problems are related to the design and about half are related to the implementation. Gary, you got more you want to talk about here?
No.
Okay, let's keep going. All right, so some of us around here had been preaching security religion for, the last decade or so. And when I say security religion, what I mean is faith-based security.
Hallelujah.
Faith-based security in that, if I tell you, well, you can come up with some secure software. First you do this, and then you do that, and then you turn around, and then everything's going to be cool. So there's more than one software security religion out there, in addition to this guy with software security, building security in, or the digital touch points. There's the Microsoft guys, Howard and Lipner, with the security development lifecycle. There's also the open source OWASP guys with their CLASP methodology. All of these books or methodologies have been about trying to create that security development lifecycle that we've been talking about. From up close, they've got their differences, but you back up a little bit, and they really all look about the same when they hit on many of the points I mentioned in the first slide, which is you gotta think about requirements, you gotta think about design, you gotta think about creating code, and then you gotta think about what happens after you release it.
So Brian said the word gotta, and I think the word for faith-based software security was really oughta. Or should, or follow me because I'm going that way, right? So all these things had charismatic leaders in the core, and there were a bunch of ideas that may work if we're lucky. And the question is, hey, haven't we been doing this long enough to find out what actually does work by studying some initiatives that have been doing this for a while? So that's kind of what we hit on, and that is what this BSIM, or Building Security and Maturity Model, is about. Just call it the BSIM. That's what we call it for short. So there's kind of a story behind this. Brian has a technical advisory board at Fortify that I'm on. And last year, around August, Brian asked one of his guys to build a maturity model for software security, kind of a religion 2.0. You can think of it as CLASP 2. And the idea was, let's tell people what they should do in a software security initiative. But when we looked at that model, the problem that I had with it was, having run 5 or 6 initiatives, the model didn't look like the things that I'd seen out there in the field. And so I had this kind of obvious idea, why don't we, instead of building a model and hoping everybody follows us that way and forming yet another branch of religion, why don't we instead try to do some science? Why don't we find out what some of these companies are doing and build a model based on observation? So we're trying really hard to build this kind of scientific basis for what it is that we're doing.
Stay here for a moment.
And the cool thing is, we had a data set to pull from.
So I'll say this. People don't build software in any one way. The world hasn't come to a decision about what the best way to go about making something that functions the way you want it to is. We shouldn't expect that they're going to come to one way in order to make secure software either. However, we think maybe there are a couple of good ideas that will dominate. And so that's what we went looking for when we studied these companies, is what's common? How can we find common ground across a lot of different kinds of software and a lot of different kinds of ways of building software?
Uh-oh, I lost the mouse. There it is. So I've been keeping track of companies that have large-scale software security initiatives for a while now, ever since the SDL, Secure SDLC idea started catching on. Really around 2005, 2006, people started talking about this. And here's a list of 46 companies that have some kind of software security initiative underway. And you can see that the financial services vertical definitely dominates the space, followed by independent software vendors. That's what ISVs is about. But it's no longer the case that nobody is doing software security. Now it's the case that a lot of people have sort of been doing it their own way, that whatever works for their organization. So we decided to pick 9 of what we considered to be the best companies doing software security, that is, companies doing the best job with software security, and study them and build a model based on observations. So without any further ado, here are the 9 that we picked. You can see some of these names are pretty easy to recognize. Google, Microsoft, Adobe, who's having wonderful issues with software security these days, is really taking this much more seriously now. The DTCC is a financial services organization in New York that clears 1.8? I think it's $1.8 quadrillion dollars
a year
worth of transactions a year in Wall Street. Wells Fargo is a big bank. And there were 2 other financial services firms that we studied. Yes, Patrick. Because we thought they were doing the best job.
Out of the
46.
We thought they were doing the best job. And they would talk to us. I'll tell you one thing that stunned me out of this piece of work is the fact that we could put this slide together. That not only were these organizations willing to talk to us, they were willing to say that they'd talk to us.
And we didn't expect that. In fact, we went in with no expectations at all, other than we're going to gather data and see what kind of model we build out of that. We had no idea what the model was going to look like. We had no idea whether it was going to have activities and levels like it ended up having. And we figured we would have to do something really, deeply unsatisfying by saying, we studied 9 big companies and they did some stuff, right? What happened was, when we went and talked to these guys and showed them the results of what we built, they all said, with the exception of 2, we want to be involved in that and we're happy to have you use our name. Which kind of, that's one thing that surprised us. The other thing that really surprised us was I don't know if you figured this, that the model was going to bifurcate into 2 models. One for financial services organizations, where there's a lot of, command and control, and you have all sorts of regulations you got to comply with, compliance issues, versus ISVs, where it's people building software for a living, and that they would approach software security in a different way. It turns out that was, my intuition was incorrect along those lines. And in fact, they're so similar that one model works nicely to explain their behavior.
So we'll come back to a little bit more data on exactly how you can compare them later. One more thing about these organizations. So historically speaking, companies haven't shared a whole lot of information about their internal security processes. And that probably overall is not good for the world, but it's good for us. It means that we've got 9 relatively independent data points. So when we find commonality between these guys, we think that's stronger than if they'd been sharing a bunch of information up front.
There's another related problem, too, which has to do with our own community. So the reason I asked the question I asked after the Android talk was many companies that are doing a great job with their own internal security groups are finding all sorts of really interesting problems and attacks, especially architectural issues that lead to potential attacks that need to be eradicated. But they're not really sharing them anymore. So I was sitting next to Felton, and you know, back in 1996, a lot of people were discovering problems, and we were all talking about them. And all the companies that had the problems had no choice but to talk about them and how they got solved. But now that corporations are getting better at doing security themselves, the sharing thing is getting a little bit iffier. You know, it's nice to hear a talk about Android security, but I saw highlighted problems discovered by external people. And I'd kind of want to know, what's the coolest thing that the Google guys found by themselves that surprised them? You know, and that's the sort of thing we're hoping, that if we build the right sort of community around this work, that kind of sharing will be more easily accomplished. And we found some evidence of that. We gave a talk on this stuff at RSA last year, and here's how good we are at marketing. Now, the people that participated in this study called us up and said, "Hey, aren't you guys? Can't we just all get together and meet those other guys at RSA?" And we were like, "Yeah, that's a good idea." You know, so the Adobe guy got to meet the Microsoft guy. You guys all know these. Well, Brad Arkin got to meet Steve Lipner, who got to meet David Hahn from Wells. And they, you know, now they talk to each other. And they're sharing information about their software security initiatives. So what we did after we had this big idea was we called up these companies and said, "Hey, we're going to do some science. We're going to come and talk to you about your software security initiative. We're not going to give you 400 questions. We're not going to ask you a checklist thing. We're just going to say, so, how did your software security initiative get started? What's the story behind it? Well, how do you train all of your guys? What kind of tools do you use?" And so on. Do a ton of listening. The way this process worked is Brian and I and Sammy Miguez, who's our co-author, spent 2 hours chatting about a software security initiative with each of these executives. And these are guys who run a number of people and who have direct responsibility and authority to do software security. So we weren't talking to some guy who does code review on the side in between his real job. We were instead talking to the executive at Microsoft who runs the 100 guys who do software security every day for a living, and asking them about that. Now, in order to guide the conversation, we wanted to build a framework that we could fill in with the data so that when we heard something about training, we would put over here, and when we heard something about deployment, we would put it over there. So we built a software security framework that guided these in-person executive interviews, and I'm going to show you that in just a second. And then after we gathered all the data, we started building lists of activities that we saw. That's the key thing here. This work is about what we saw out there, not about whether it's good or whether it's bad or whether it works or whether it doesn't work. We wanted to start out incredibly basic. We observed these guys doing this behavior. And so we all independently, all three of us were in the interview process, we built our own list of what we thought we saw, and then we got together and we had a big fight in my kitchen about what we saw versus what we didn't see and who wrote down what. And it would often go like this. Brian would say, "Oh yeah, they did foo." And I would say, no, I think he said they did bar. And our co-author Sammy would go, "Well, what they actually said," and I quote, "was," and Sammy had written down every single word that everybody said. So he was always able to pull out some quote and get over those arguments. And then we built this model. So here's the framework. that good with that?
Yeah, sure. I'll start in explaining the framework. So we divided the world of a software security initiative inside a big company into four domains: governance, intelligence, SSDL touchpoints. Got to tell the story about that title when we get there. And then finally, deployment. Okay. Within each of those domains, we identified practices. So three practices in each domain. Do you notice this is kind of neat and pretty? Much neater and prettier than any organization really is. You can kind of think of this as the way you might do archaeology. You get to a site you want to investigate, and then you put up some strings. You just start making quadrants on that site so that you can talk about the different things that you find. Now, those quadrants in and of themselves don't particularly mean anything. But until you have that quadrant system, you can't talk about what you find. So that this is our quadrant system. This is how we want to talk about the software security initiative.
There's another key aspect here, which is nomenclature. So as we all know, having been in security for more than 5 minutes, if you've been in for more than 5 minutes, you know everybody uses words completely differently. And so what we wanted to do with the framework was say, here's the words we're going to use. Let's just use these words. And that seemed to work pretty well.
All right, so shall we start taking some of this stuff apart? I think we got enough time. We could unpack the whole thing.
Yeah, if you want.
Yeah, okay. So in governance, we talk about strategy and metrics. What's the big picture game plan, and how are you going to figure out whether you were successful with your big picture game plan or not? Compliance and policy. So do you live in an environment where you've got to comply with some external drivers? And then what are you going to tell people your policy is about how you're going to meet those compliance requirements? Finally, training. How are you going to explain to the people who do the work what it is you want them to do?
Or personnel development is another way of thinking about it. So all the way to the left, you have thinking that involves running a large-scale initiative in a big company. And it turns out that doing software security, doing a big initiative, is kind of a cultural change that you're wielding often on tens of thousands of people who write code all the time. So you have to plan it kind of carefully, and you have to get a lot of budget, and you have to expect it's going to take a while. And so that's kind of what the governance thing is all about.
Next up, you also need a big pile of information about security. And we call that intelligence. At the top, we start with attack models. How do you expect your systems are going to be attacked? Next, security features and design.
And who would do it?
Oh, who's going to attack you? That's an important part, too. You're right. Okay, so security features and design. So up front, we said that software security is not all about security features. But guess what? You're going to need some cryptography now and then. You're going to need to be able to authenticate users. So you've got to do that stuff, too.
Oh, yeah, and when you tell people don't roll your own, you should tell them what to use instead. You can't just say don't roll your own.
Lastly, standards and requirements.
So unless you're Gutman, he can roll his own. You're good. No problem.
So while you might have a policy that says thou shalt do this, you might also have some standard ways of getting that job done and that help people get the job done, and we put that in that bucket. Any roll-up on intelligence, Gary, or should we move right on to trying to figure out whether people did it right?
Well, this is the hilarious part. So this next column used to be called SDL touchpoints. And you know Microsoft uses the term SDL to talk about their SDLC integration of best practices. Well, when Microsoft looked at our framework, they said, we own the term SDL. So they think it's already been band-aided, which is kind of interesting. And in order to get them to play along, we just stuck another S. So you can think of that as either software security development lifecycle or Steve's security development lifecycle for Lipner.
Okay, but all the stuff that you find in here is about trying to figure out whether you built the right thing. So at the top, we put architecture analysis, which is about finding those design flaws. So how do you analyze a design and find problems with it? Next up is code review. How do you look at an implementation and figure out whether it's got bugs in it that are going to jeopardize the security of the system? And lastly, security testing. So I'll tell you one of the things that we did that I thought might get us in trouble when we first created this model, but turned out to be okay, was split out security testing from penetration testing.
Everybody see that?
So penetration testing went in that deployment column at the end. What we're talking about when we talk about security testing is before you ship that code, how do you figure out whether you like what you've got in there?
And it's white box in nature. Often.
Yeah, okay.
So,
But the important, I think the distinguishing factor is you haven't screwed up yet. If you find problems in that penetration test, that's a deployed system. That means you've deployed a system that is vulnerable. Okay, so on to the deployment category. I guess I've already covered penetration testing. Sorry, Gary, you want to?
No, the one thing I want to jump in and say about deployment is usually software security doesn't cover that. And usually software security, like if you read my book or if you read Lipner's book on the SDL, you just don't see anything about management or about how to work with the normal security guys who have to do operations. And believe it or not, that's a critical part of making software security actually work. Because you can build something great and then completely screw it up at that end of the world. So we wanted to make sure that we saw that interface and that we described that interface when we were doing this science here.
So these last two, software environment and configuration management and vulnerability management, cover most of what something like COBIT would do. And we scrunch them all down into this bottom right-hand corner. So, software environment, do you have the right kind of nest for that piece of software that you created to live in? And configuration and vulnerability management is all about, can you go about modifying that software when you need to?
Let's say you found a bug. How would you eradicate it in your code base? Turns out that's a harder problem than you might imagine.
So you can see here that we're not trying to make a map of the entire universe. We're not trying to be bigger than an existing standard like COBIT. We're trying to look at the software security problem, and these are elements of it, but they're not the dominant elements of it.
So if we'd been following the old religion, faith-based software security, at this point we would start just making stuff up, right? Well, this is what you ought to do for code review, and this is the kind of tool everybody should buy, and first you should sacrifice a goat on Wednesdays, and you know, all sorts of other stuff. But we stuck to our guns. And just to make this ridiculously clear, I want to tell you an analogy. It's like we went into the jungle and we made some observations. And the only thing we're going to do in this model is say what we saw. So what we saw is monkeys eat bananas. What we don't say is yellow bananas are better than green bananas. Don't run while you eat bananas. Don't steal your neighbor monkey's bananas. You should do banana procurement this way. Instead, we wanted to keep it really simple and say simple things like monkeys eat bananas. So all the things that we observed are of that order. Does that make sense to everybody? This is new. You know, the notion was, instead of going out and imposing our view of what ought to be, why don't we just go out and see what is and what seems to be working and describe that?
So the reason why we've gone over this twice now is that for the people who were busy working on their religions, this turned out to be kind of a hard point to accept. So you might not think that what we're doing here is very controversial, but to a lot of these guys who have a way they want to see the job done, they're uncomfortable with the idea that you would merely observe and report back what people actually do.
So here's some stuff that we found as a side effect of doing this work. We just asked some simple questions about how long has your software security initiative been around? And how big is your software security group?
SSG, software security.
And how big is the development group, generally speaking? And so let's talk about this slide a little bit. The initiative age is very clear. And, you know, some organizations have been at it for much longer than others. So you can see the oldest one is 10, and this was back in October when we gathered the data. And the newest one was 2.5. And the newest one is, you know, now understanding that new isn't always good. So you can figure out who they are if you think just a little bit. Now, one thing about software security group that's really interesting is we didn't have to say, do you have a software security group? Do you have a group who has responsibility and authority to get this job done? The answer was always yes. So there are a lot of people that have come to us after we built this model and said, hey, we'd like to use your model. And we say, do you have a software security group? And they say, no. And we say, you're not ready for the model. Go get a software security group first. then let's figure out how to do a software security initiative. You know, and this is kind of a, this might be lost on a too technical of a crowd, but this is a management 101 thing. You know, software security suffered from this problem. The security guys were pointing at the software guys and going, yeah, our network's great, and they keep building this crap and putting it on it. And the software guys, what were they saying?
We've already got a job. Security people, you figure out how to fix this.
Right, and you see who's standing in the middle? Nobody. So who's going to get software security done? No, nobody. Nobody. Who's getting fired? Nobody. Who's getting a bonus? Nobody. If you're a management person, nobody's the wrong answer, right? So first you get somebody, and then you staff somebody up, and you give them some resources, and you give them some authority and some responsibility to get this done. So we found out how big software security groups were as part of this process. And you can see that the average size is 41. And you can see the large and small and the median there. The other thing that we uncovered was this notion of a satellite, which is people that are involved in software security, but not as their day-to-day job. Is what Brian likes to say is they don't have security on their card anywhere. They may be embedded in one of the product groups, and often they are. Or maybe they're part of enterprise architecture, or maybe whatever. But these guys are affiliated with the software security initiative, just not directly. They're not direct line reports. Some companies that we observed have a satellite like this, and some do not. Now, the interesting thing was, and this shows you the effect of this work, it's kind of like, you know, Heisenberg's principle. When we told the people who don't have a satellite that there were other people who did have a satellite, the people who didn't have a satellite immediately got a satellite. Because it's a good idea. And that's part of the interesting thing that happened with some of this work was lots of cross-pollination. People found out what their peers were doing and stole some of the good ideas to use for themselves, which is kind of part of what we wanted to accomplish. So that was pretty cool. Then if you compare the software security group size with the size of the development group, you can begin to say interesting things like, we observed that SSG size on average is 1% the size of development. So now you can say to yourself, as somebody planning a software security initiative, how big your software security group might ought to be based on real data. That's kind of an interesting thing.
One more point here about the size of these development organizations. So we studied three orders of magnitude of development organizations. People who count their developers in the hundreds, the thousands, and the tens of thousands. So there's one really important order of magnitude left off. What is it?
One.
It's the itty-bitties. So what can we tell you about how security plays out in the itty-bitties? Nothing. We don't know how it should or how it could play out if you are writing an iPhone app in your garage. We don't know what happens when you expand to be a development team of size 10. We started studying sort of medium size to big organizations. That suits our purposes just fine, but it is a limitation of this work.
Right. So another thing that we uncovered were these things that surprised us. And these aren't really part of the model at all. These are just things that we didn't really expect when we went out into the jungle and started making our observations. So there are 10 things on here, and maybe we can pick two or three. Take just, you know, 5 seconds and read that list and think of what your favorite one is that you want to hear about, and then we'll tell you about it.
Let me say this. There are two, this is kind of unfortunate that there are two lists in this presentation. They both got 10 things on them. Mm. The second list that we're going to talk about, it's got 10 things because there are 10 observations that meet a certain set of criteria. This top 10 list, completely arbitrary. This is some stuff we thought was interesting enough to make it into a list, right?
So anybody want to hear about any of those in particular, yell it out. What?
Metrics.
Metrics. Oh, you always pick number one. All right, bad metrics hurt. Now, everybody wants metrics, and we gave a talk at Metricon about this yesterday. Everybody, in fact, uses metrics, but the organizations collectively never use the same metrics. They use pretty different metrics that are suited for their own culture. And in fact, We went to Metricon to say the following sentence, and I get to say it to you now. Metrics are like internal organs in a body. They're really important, and you probably should have some. But if you want to borrow somebody else's internal organs, that's expensive, and the chances of rejection from the body are high. So watch out for that. And that's what we found by observing metrics. But it got even worse. We went to one place where we said, so tell us about metrics. And they went, oh my God, do we have to talk about that? And they got all worried. And you know what? We said, well, geez, what was the deal? And they said, well, we accidentally once put one bad metric in the organization and we turned it on and we can't turn it off. And it's bad and it doesn't work. And it was, all code must compile with no lint warnings, right? And so it sounds sort of innocuous. Well, there were some little sneaky developer buggers who came up with a glob o code that lint chokes on and dies. And it emits how many warnings after it's dead? Zero! So this little glob of magical lint-killing code has managed to propagate itself all throughout the code base of this organization. And you can tell people, it doesn't matter about the lint thing, don't do that anymore, which they've been doing for 5 years. But because that metric was imposed so hard, they can't eradicate it. That's an example of bad metrics hurt. So don't let that be you. Let's do one other one.
Hey, I'm gonna pick one here.
Oh,
you guys, let them take a little more time to sear with a good. I wanna talk about number three. Nobody uses WAFs because first of all, I don't know if everybody knows what a WAF is. It's a web application firewall, and this is a little bit of almost legal trickery going on here because it isn't nobody has WAFs. It's nobody uses web application firewalls.
Well, in fact, it's almost nobody has them.
It's two out of the nine
right.
The groups that we talked to had web application firewalls, and in fact, had them running in production environments. But they weren't using them like a firewall. You think about a firewall, it's supposed to let some things through and then not let other things through. That's not what these guys were doing. They were using them in order to figure out what kinds of inputs were being delivered up to their software, but they were letting everything through.
Well, you know, so this may not be so surprising for the Usenix crowd, actually.
Yeah,
so, you know, if you go out and you do this at a trade show full of practitioners, they all sort of believe the crap that the web application firewall vendors are telling them, and they think that PCI isn't utterly full of crap the way that it is. And so they look at, you know, thing number six, and it says, either review your code or get a WAF. And, you know, that makes me go, oh, my God, who wrote this? But there's a difference between Usenix land and, you know, corporate America land. Let's pick one more. Who's got another one they want to? Yeah. Number seven, practitioners don't talk attacks. This is really interesting. Now, I'm the guy who wrote Exploiting Software in 2004. In fact, I gave a Usenix talk about that in 2004, long ago. So I believe in attacks, and I absolutely think talking about how real attacks work is incredibly important. But what we found out when we went to the jungle and made some observations was talking about attacks is really important for your software security group and the guys who have to do the pen tests and some people who need to think maliciously. But you don't have to teach all your developers how to think like bad guys. Instead, you should teach your developers how to build stuff properly. So things like defensive coding and do it this way, not here's a bug, there's a bug, bug parade, yada, yada, yada. Now, if you look at a lot of training that's available commercially, it turns out to be here's a bug, there's a bug, bug parade, yada, yada, yada. And you know, there's plenty of that because the bugs are sexy. But it turns out that teaching the developers how to think like attackers is not something that we observe.
So if everything you know about software security you learn by reading CNET, you would think that this is all about attacks, right? Because those are the headlines you read are about attacks, because those are kind of interesting and wow, and I never thought that could happen kind of stuff. So it makes for good news. It's not bad if you're a consultant because you get to tell people about all the brilliant things that you've been able to crack open, too. In fact, if you're a practitioner, you might begin to get a little bit of an inferiority complex about the fact that your whole organization isn't as up on attacks as it would appear the rest of the world is. But it's not so.
So we wrote about the other, how many did we do?
Three? We did three.
The other seven things in a little article you can get on the net if you want. So back to the model itself. Here are the basics of the model. So we started with that framework, and then we observed a bunch of activities. We did not set out to observe X number of activities per one of those little buckets. You know, there were 12 of those practices. Instead, we just said, well, however many we see, that's however many we're going to write down. And it turned out that that number was 110, and they're not divided evenly between the 12 practices. There is no practice that has zero activities, so I will say that, but they're not all equally balanced because we weren't trying to build a beautiful, perfectly formed model. Instead, we were trying to build a model of what we saw out there in the world. So there turned out to be 110 activities, and in the document, which you can get on the net, it's available for free, and it's under Creative Commons, so you can use it however you want at bsi-mm.com. In the document, every single activity description also has a real story about how we saw that activity in the world. Now, the story is a little bit scrubbed because we don't say, Microsoft did foo. We just say, we saw foo. But every activity is not a theory. It's not, we think you should do it because, you know, we're smart guys. Instead, the activity is, we saw this, and here's an example of this from out there, which I think is an important distinction. Now, once you've got those activities, you can use them as kind of a yardstick to see how tall you are. And you can hold it up against yourself this week, and you can hold it up against yourself in a year from now, and you can find out how tall your friends are, and you can do all sorts of comparisons. And in fact, it's somewhat similar to this notion of just taking a column of mercury and drawing some lines on it, and then using it to figure out, you know, how hot and cold things are out there in the world. So that's kind of our idea behind the BSIM.
Now, in order to make that yardstick, we've got to make some decisions about maturity of particular activities. In some cases, that's reasonably arbitrary. We have to say, we think this is a higher level of thinking than that. In many cases, though, it's dictated to us. So, for instance, if you're using static analysis to do code review, that's a good thing. If you are actually customizing that static analysis to look for the things you want to look for, well, you have to be using static analysis first, so we can separate those two and say there's an obvious ordering to that set of activities.
So basically, another way of putting it is the activities that we observe self-organized into three levels. And the levels have nothing to do with CMM maturity levels at all. In fact, maybe we should have called them something else, but we call them levels anyway. And the levels are, oh yeah, that's pretty easy, we ought to be doing that. That's level one. Level two is, sometimes takes level one stuff to get done before you can do this. And level three is, wow, that's a great idea, but that sounds hard. And those were the way we organized the activities. We didn't get any pushback on assigning activities into levels. But here's what we're doing. We almost have enough data gathered to have a statistically significant sample. Once we have that, we will be able to adjust the model according to statistics and build levels out of clusters. The preliminary analysis says that our division into levels is the right way to do it. But you know what? We're just going to let the data dictate that. We're not going to decide that for ourselves. So that's how the thing works. So imagine you have this framework. You good with this?
One more point that I think bears repeating there. Although we identified 110 activities, you can't think of it as a dictionary of 110 things that you have to do before your software can truly be secure.
Oh, absolutely not. Yep.
It's just the 110 things that we observe.
Right. So there is no auto. Everybody clear on that? It just means somebody did it. Maybe they're crazy. All right. So let's dig into the framework. Imagine that you click on training here. Here's what you see in the skeleton part of the document. So you can see that there are three levels there. One level is gray, that's level two, and then there's level one up above that and level three at the bottom. And you can see that each activity has a very short label, like provide awareness training, but it also has an objective. Now, the objective is important for business reasons. This is kind of a subtle point that really matters. You can't just go to management and say, we gotta do static analysis, or we gotta train our people. Because that's not how things work in business. Instead, you say something like, don't you think we should promote a culture of security throughout the organization? Now, who's gonna disagree with that? Anybody? And once the answer is yes, you've sold the car, and you go, oh, well, yes, well, how we're going to do that is by providing awareness training. See that difference? That's absolutely essential to getting things done in large organizations. And we built this model so that you can drive it all the way from motherhood, apple pie, and Chevrolet's gone. Who's the new Chevrolet? What? General Motors? I don't know. Yeah, it's problematic. You know, what's next? Apple pie is deleted. So these concepts that no one can disagree with, all the way down to really particular objectives that have to do with particular activities, we wanted to make it easy for the poor guy who has to justify this initiative to management, or who is management and needs to justify to the board, which is often the case in an SSG, how to do that. So that's part of that's one of the important aspects of the model. Now let's just pick one of these. If we clicked on a cool one like training 1.3, so it's activity 3 in level 1 of training, establish SSG office hours. It turns out that inside the document, there's a whole paragraph devoted to each one of these things in the skeleton, and here's what it looks like. So establish SSG office hours. The SSG offers to help any and all comers during a lab period or regularly scheduled office hours by acting as an informal resource for people who want to solve the problem. The SSG leverages teachable moments and emphasizes the carrot over the stick. Now, isn't that interesting? We sort of thought we were going to see the guys in New York, the financial services people, and also Boston, using a stick sometimes. Your code is bad. Bam! Don't do that again. You're fired. Or, you know, no bonus for you. But instead, what we saw evidence of all over the place was, we built a resource, we're here to help, we want to make your job easier. Don't call people's babies ugly when you're doing software security. Nobody likes that. You can't say, gosh, that was cool that it compiled, but I don't know about those three arms. You know, it just doesn't work that way. So you have to figure out how to do this right. And this office hours idea was very clever and really easy. And so the observable was, office hours could be held one afternoon a week in the office of a senior SSG member. That's what we actually observed. That's, you know, one company did that. And when we told the other guys, when they read the model, they were like, ooh, dude, that's really easy. I'm going to do that. So now everybody's doing it, which was kind of an interesting part of cross-fertilization. So inside the model, inside this yardstick of 110 activities is enough information to hopefully describe what we observed and a way that that worked for somebody. Once again, just because we observed an activity doesn't mean you should do it. This is not about should. This is about what we saw.
I'll tell you, the one point that I got feedback on as soon as we released the model is an analyst took a look at it, and he took a look at one of those level three activities. And that level three activity involved having a subset of your security organization that was purely devoted to research. They looked at that and they said, why, that would be really expensive. It's pretty clear from that paragraph that you're spending a couple $1 million a year doing that thing. How in the world could you expect everybody to do that? We came back and we said, no. Everybody in the world doesn't have to have that organization.
Well, this is the classic analyst read. He read the paper by opening up to page 47 and throwing a dart. Read a paragraph and ask a question.
The point is that somebody out there has done that. All right, let's talk about the Big Ten.
All right, so here's what you get when you go out and you measure a bunch of diverse organizations with the same yardstick. Remember, in the beginning of the BSIM, we didn't have the yardstick. Now we do, and we've published the yardstick, and we're still wielding it. We're still gathering data and measuring other companies. We've done another 8 since we first published this work. There are some things that every single organization does. Well, actually, we defined it as 8, that a huge majority of the organizations do. And those 10 things are written down right there. And we have an article about that, too. But maybe we should talk about one or two of those. You want to pick them, or you want to go random?
Oh, we should let them pick them. So you guys pick one or two. I'll tell you, SSG does ARA is a little acronym heavy. That's the Software Security Group doing architectural risk analysis. So that's the central security team looking for design problems.
So who wants to hear about any one of those activities? They're fairly straightforward. Yes, please. Code review tools, hit it.
Yeah, sure. So everybody is doing code review, and if you spent much time doing code review, you know, doing it with your eyeballs alone kind of sucks. And so people look for ways to automate it. Some of them use commercial stuff like Fortify. Some of them have done their own kinds of stuff. The point here is everybody is doing code review, and they're all looking for ways to automate parts of that job.
So this was an interesting one, because when we first wrote down the activities that everybody did, code review with a tool didn't make the list because we didn't see that everywhere. And we went and showed results to the 9, and this one company, they looked at that and they said, well, God, we do that. Here's the tool right here, and we forgot to talk about that, but we do that. So we had to add it into the model, and it populated all the way to the top, which was kind of an interesting thing. So that's one example. Now, think about these 10 things that everybody does in a more subtle than you should do this fashion. Remember what your mother used to say about when you would go and you would say, well, everybody's doing it, right? And your mother says, you're not everybody. Everybody else is an idiot, right? Didn't everybody's mother said that? But so you can take it with a grain of salt. It doesn't mean you have to do it. It just means that successful programs, successful initiatives appear to be doing that. We observe that they are doing that. And you can take that any way you want.
Okay, pick another.
Yeah, way back there. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so that's the security group is doing the design review. And basically, this was back on one of the top 10 surprising things is where this thread gets started, is it turns out, you'll be shocked to hear this, that doing architectural analysis is hard.
It's really hard.
So what does that mean?
I got to tell this story. All right, so we go to Microsoft, and we're talking about architecture analysis, and they call it threat modeling. We're talking about threat modeling. And we said, oh, yeah, well, you guys even published how you do threat modeling. And they go, yeah, that's not how we do it. I said, well, why not? Well, because that was version, 2.4 or something. And now we're on version 5. And we found out that way just doesn't work. It doesn't scale. It's good when you have Mike, but it doesn't scale. That was really interesting. Even the own kind of religion way of doing it didn't really work for the people who came up with the release.
Hey, you know, we haven't talked about the alternative here. So the alternative to having that security team do the design review is to have the people who own that product do the design review.
Right.
In a lot of cases, when they do their own code review, or they do a big chunk of their own code review job. So in some sense, that code review problem appears to be easier from some high-level view, and people can do a decent job of wringing bugs out of their own code. But doing a systematic job of evaluating their design for security problems appears to just be a harder thing to do.
And nobody does design wrong on purpose, right? So.
And so that central security group has a larger chunk of that work that they're involved with helping people do that review.
Makes sense? Yeah. All right, so now let's talk about these little spider diagrams. Yes. That's correct.
Hold on.
You
put a should in the sentence. So we got to take the should out of the sentence. So the
yeah. That's right. We saw them do this.
Not all organizations do a design review in the same fashion. They do it though,
and they have the software security group do it.
So sort of on the low end of things, they go down a checklist of security features.
Now, is that high enough resolution to know how you should do it in your organization? No, it's not. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, what you should take away from it is, if you're not doing architecture risk analysis at all, which many organizations are not, a lot of people are. Maybe you should think about it. But no should. You should think about it, but you shouldn't necessarily do it, right? Yeah.
I'll tell you, from a research perspective, if you're looking through BSIM for the problems people kind of have under control and the problems that they don't so much have under control, trying to get people to do their own design review is a problem that isn't solved.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for something to push on, that's one to push on.
We used to have that problem 6 years ago with code review before the code review tools got, you know, better than crappy. And now that they're almost kind of usable, a lot more people are doing regular code review than used to be. Unfortunately, I don't see the same thing happening in architectural risk analysis for a couple reasons. The main reason being, and this is just a little science aside, if you look at problems in computer security over the years, they kind of chunk up. The first chunk is configured incorrectly. The second chunk is stupid bug. The third chunk is design problem. And the fourth chunk is trust issues. And we've made our way in the world right to the edge of configuration problems, almost into bug land. And so we still have flaws to come, and we still have trust issues after that. And I think that natural evolution is something that we're going to see. There was a question over here. Yeah, so this was a group that was formed specifically to do software security. It was formed a different way in the 9 organizations. The history behind it was not always the same. But what we can say now is how they are organized. And we have a few stories about how some got started. But there is no one way to do it. And every organization is going to have a different way of kicking off a large-scale initiative. You know, the Microsoft way of Gates says, by God, we're turning the thing 2 degrees to the left and security is important to all developers is one way to do it, but not the only way to do it. But I do want to emphasize, every one of these organizations does have a group of people who are actually responsible for software security. And that software security group has an internal structure in many organizations because, you know, some of them have 100 people on staff. And so that means there's some internal organization inside of that.
So nobody in the software security group spends any time at all configuring a firewall. Nobody in the software security group occasionally runs Nessus, and that led them to find a cross-site scripting vulnerability once. That's not what we're talking about.
Right. Right. Good point. All right. So when you hold up the yardstick against these 9 organizations, then you can start slicing and dicing the data, and you can build things like average tallness for our 12 domains. And you can see that little red chart, average maturity over the 9. Around the circle are those 12 things that were in our archaeology grid. And each of those 12 things, every organization got a score. The score was based on a very simple calculation. This is it. If you do anything in level 2 at all, you get a 2. If you do anything in level 3 at all, you get a 3. If you do anything in level 1, you get a 1. Make sense? It's called high water mark. It actually worked, this low-resolution probe, collapsing the data down to just one number for practice in every case except for one. So that's 12 times 9 minus 1. And in the case where it didn't work, that is, the high water mark said they got a 3, but actually 2 was pretty sparse, and they just got lucky and did 3. We went to the organization, we said, well, you guys got a 3, but you're really not very good at this. And they said, oh, yeah, we don't deserve that 3, which is kind of an interesting thing. What we wanted, though, was a low-resolution way of comparing averages and then mapping your own organization against your peers. Now, of course, everybody wants to be above average, just like Lake Wobegon. But that's not the way the math works. However, you can take a look at where you are ahead and behind the curve. So the bottom chart shows an artificial data set of blue, that is the client, mapped on top of the average of all 9. And this is very interesting. When we showed these results to the people who were running these programs, they said, I see, so we're behind a little bit on code review, behind the curve, actually code review is not an example. We're behind on security testing. See the ST over there? So the average is doing a better job with security testing than we are. Maybe that's somewhere we should invest some resources. This helps you to know where you stand according to your peers, which is a really interesting thing. And it's brand new to this marketplace. You know, the notion of talking to your peers and seeing what they're doing and what works is something that we're trying to engender.
So people got excited when we showed them these scores, partially because the people in charge of those security organizations have a really tough problem. When they want to justify why they want to make additional investments in a particular area, how do they do that? How do they explain, my feeling is we're probably missing some bugs. We think we probably need to beef up the testing. That's very, very difficult to take up your management chain. When we could go to them and say, hey, you're actually below average here, then it's really easy to go up the management chain and say, we want to be doing at least as much as our neighbors are doing in this domain. So this turned out to be really powerful for the people in the study.
So we have evidence that some of these guys went, wow, and they went to the board and they funded what they wanted to do anyway because now they had real data behind it. No, because the norm across these 9 companies, only these 9 companies, it was as small as that. So even with a tiny little data set, there's still enough momentum to cause.
Because we're taking them from no data to some data, right? So I mean that's a big leap for these guys. Well, as Gary likes to talk about the arms race for the common good.
Yeah. Let me zoom in one level of resolution because this will help. So here's a scorecard that we built for all 110 activities for an organization. Let me unpack this for you. The first thing you should notice is that there is a little rectangle, glob, for every one of the 12 practices. So you can see that there's sort of 12 globs on there with white things in them. Inside of those 12 globs are each activity. The activity has a number that says observed in the observed column. That's how many times we saw a particular activity out there in the jungle among our data set of 9. The 10 things that everybody does, which we spent a little bit of time on, are all yellow. When we compare the data from this hypothetical organization against the scorecard grid, what you see when you look at the yellow is if they did the yellow thing, they get a green box and a 1. On the other hand, if they didn't do one of the activities that everybody else did, they got a red box. Now, the red box doesn't mean you should do this activity. It just means, warning, Will Robinson, everyone else is doing this. Do you have a story about why you're not? Which is kind of an interesting thing. Now, if we go back to the spider from the previous slide, you can see that there are places where the blue is on the wrong side, so to speak, of the red. And we want to shift that blue so that it's nearer to the average, probably, or maybe over the average. And those areas, those practices, are denoted with the blue swath. So you can see this hypothetical company needed to work on security requirements and security testing and compliance and policy. There's sort of three major areas. Not only can the model automatically spit that out, you know, consider these areas because you're behind the average, can also say, here are some particular activities in those areas that, you know, a bunch of organizations are doing, so maybe that means it's working for them and you should consider it. So that, when you give this kind of data to somebody who's been running a software security group in the dark without knowing how they compare to their peers, or, you know, really whether or not they were investing enough or too much, all of a sudden you've got some real data for comparison with your peers and the rest of the industry. And as Brian said before, our sneaky secret goal behind all this is to cause an arms race for the common good. So that everybody says, well, I'm this tall, and then they start growing, and everybody's getting taller and taller, and we end up with better software security all around, all over the place. Anything to add?
I never imagined that I'd run into people who were happy to get a report card again. I kind of was happy to not get report cards anymore after that was over. People were really excited about seeing how they stack up to this level of detail.
Now, in the beginning of the talk, I said that we went out and we gathered data and we built a model based on what we observed. And then we applied the model. And I also said that I had an intuition that we might have to bifurcate the model into one for independent software vendors and another one for financial services firms. And that intuition was wrong. In fact, one model did fit, but you can actually look at the averages and compare them to each other. So you can see financial services in blue on this spider diagram and ISVs in green. And there are a couple of kind of interesting things. It looks like, generally speaking, the software guys, the ISVs that are green, spend more effort on testing than the financial services organizations, just sort of in general. So they're doing more penetration testing and they're doing more white box security testing. On the other hand, not surprisingly, the financial services people are doing a little bit more when it comes to compliance and policy, and also training their people to adhere with these policy constraints that they're putting on. So you can see the beginnings of a little bit of a difference, but the overlap is so large that one model seemed to fit really nicely. Now, I want to emphasize this. We are letting the data drive this model completely. We're gathering more data. If the data start disagreeing with the model will change. Because what we're trying to do is observe what's really going on, report it, and build a way of measuring that everybody can use, that's easy to use, so that we can engender this arms race for the common good.
This, though, the data at this point says something really important. A lot of times I'll go talk to a customer who will be in one of these camps or the other. They will be either somebody who makes software for a living, and they say, oh yeah, I've got some customers who are in that financial services vertical, but I don't have to do the same things that they have to do. In other words, I have a different set of security concerns. And we would never try and tell them that their two worlds are the same, but what we can tell them based on this data is they're more similar than they used to think, and that they actually do need to play by mostly the same rules.
The New York guys loved that result because they were being they were being told by the ISVs, well, you know, you're not really software people, and code review for you means something entirely different than it means for us. And guess what? That was just bullshit. So, here's where we stand. We released the model in March, and we released it under a Creative Commons license. And you can use the data, you can use the model, You can change the model. You can reuse the data. You can decide that we're wrong and you want to do it your own way, because that's what we want you to do. So please, for God's sakes, do that. We think that what we've built is a yardstick, and we've found that the yardstick is really incredibly useful for the people who have had it applied to them so far. So, you know, it's not a lot of victims, because we've done 17 to date, but the 17 people who have had this process applied to them have found it unbelievably useful. We are evolving the model. We've got more BSIM victims that we've collected data for, whose numbers are not in the model that we have released, but will be when we do the second release in a few months. We've done a study of European companies. We kicked that off last week by studying four large initiatives going on in Europe, and there's another five that are in the bin to collect in September. And we've also built but not yet turned on BSIM Lite, which focuses on the 10 things that everybody does and also the level one stuff, and is going to try to get to those shops of one guy or 10 guys or five guys, smaller shops, to see whether there's any interesting data there. It may well be so messy that we can't extract anything from the data, but we're going to try, and we'll let you know. Once again, though, we're letting the data drive the thing. We are going to do statistics on the model and on the data that we've gathered once we have enough data to do reasonable statistics. Now, one of our co-authors, Sammy, keeps jumping the gun, and he keeps going, look what I found in the data. And I say, go compute your Pearson coefficient, and you'll see that that doesn't matter. You know, so we're really going to try to have this thing be as tight mathematically as we can.
Doesn't matter yet.
Yeah.
It'll matter as soon as we've got enough data points.
Right. So now we're done with our official slide spiel stuffs, and we have some time for questions. So please, by all means, questions? Come up to the mics.
Yeah, so I guess I'm going to take the privilege of asking the first question. And so the model says popular, implicitly says popular is good, right?
Yeah.
Because you're measuring yourself against what's popular.
Yep.
So what kind of validation have you done? And the second question is, how do you avoid the Fonzi syndrome, right? Whatever's cool today, the Fonzi syndrome, whatever's cool today is going to be cool forever, and it's also going to be the best, greatest thing.
Two good questions. The first question is, we have absolutely no evidence that following these activities leads to more secure software. Okay? And we would like to fix that. As soon as somebody figures out how to measure more secure software, please let us know. Because we gave up on the, we're going to measure the software, and we said, you know what, we're going to have to measure what the organizations are doing, because that's the only thing we can measure. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, do you want to emulate what Microsoft has done with the Trustworthy Computing Initiative? Do you think they're doing an okay job? How about Google? Are they doing an okay job? Do you want to be like them? Well, we've now described what be like them kind of means according to this model, and that's the best we can say.
You see, part of our problem here is that none of the organizations we studied exist for the purpose of creating secure software. They've all got some other goal. So optimum for them, optimum investment in security, doesn't mean ultimate investment in security for them. So this trying to answer the effectiveness question turns out to be tough.
Now, we would love to have more validation that way, but I just don't know where the hell it's going to come from. So if you got any good ideas, please do tell. What was the coolness factor?
The Fonzi syndrome.
You know what? Microsoft is just not cool. So, okay. but Google's cool. Or no, wait, that's backwards.
Yeah. End up being better off at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm.
That's right.
So this is why we come into this, and the fact that these guys were largely operating independently. They didn't know each other. They weren't collaborating on what security activities made sense for their organizations. So at least when we began this study, we had a bunch of independent data points.
So I think instead of, those are all excellent, right on the money, hard questions that are important. But you have to compare it to the alternative, which was faith-based software security. And, you know, we're sort of collecting data and taking baby steps, and our plan is to always adhere to the data and always be about monkeys eat bananas. And so that's our big goal in the sky.
So what degree of organizational buy-in did you observe across these different companies? And I asked this question because obviously if you don't have organizational buy-in, you're not going to get anywhere. Did these different initiatives in these different companies start out as a bunch of kind of low-level drones trying to make things happen and then kind of built up, or did they start as a mid-level, you know, some mid-level management?
Okay, the answer to question two is they started out in completely diverse ways, and you can't say this is the way everybody did it. And some started as a grassroots thing, some started as a top-down thing, some started because they were in the papers all the time, and some said, oh shit, we're next, you know, let's get prepared. And there were many different motivations behind this. There are a number of activities. In fact, the whole governance idea is about large-scale management-level concerns, including buy-in, including executive sponsorship, and budgets and vendor control and involving legal. So if you check out the model, I think you'll find some of those answers, specific answers to the activities that we observed for the first part of your question.
Okay. I'll tell you one thing we did not see anywhere, and that is the ground up grassroots approach to security. We did see security starts with an executive mandate. But we never saw sort of the Wikipedia, if we give people the opportunity to build more secure code, they will do it, and they're kumbaya.
Yeah, no kumbaya.
Okay.
There are certain industries where we all expect to see better security practices than others.
Yeah.
Financial services, healthcare information.
I don't know, given the current state of the world, I'm not sure that first statement is true.
That was undeniably the worst. They had terrible practices. And
we don't have enough data to say anything conclusive.
But we have
looked at a few new verticals lately, and they're pretty darn worst. but we don't have enough data to point the finger yet.
Can you make a relative observation between the ones that you've looked at?
It's pretty large. So if you just look at base number of activities out of 110, you know, high is around 80 or so, and low is around, remember what the number is?
40, in the 40s?
In the 40s, and some of the new data points, we're getting low that's like 3. So, you know, this model we built by studying the best, and there's a discrimination among the best. In fact, you know, we were a little worried when we went and we showed some people, well, here's everybody we studied without their names, and here's where you are. You're number 7. and we were just like waiting for them to yell at us. And instead, they all sort of went, yeah. And I think they understood that being the bottom of the top isn't so bad. Now, we don't really know where the bottom is yet, because we started by observing people who we thought were doing a good job. And now we're expanding that. So we'll get back to you on that one, but that's an important question.
The top of the top was happy to have some results to show for their investment because they had invested. The bottom of the top was looking for more reasons why they can go to their management and say, we need to do more.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I do want to say, even though we released this model in a way that you can certainly use it however you want, we sort of expect it to be abused and misused, and we're resigned to seeing that happen. Like some people are going to take our yardstick and they're going to crack it up and cook a hot dog over it. That's not what we meant to do. And some people are going to self-assess, and you know, they look in the mirror every day and they think they look great. And they'll invent a story for why they do everything. So we're being careful about data collection in the model. When we expand the model, then the people that are doing the study, me or Brian or Sammy so far, have been involved in data collection every time. Up front, I'm sorry.
My question was going to be, how did you select the 9 organizations? Are they good or just big or intentionally random?
Right.
I think you said they're the best.
Right.
So what was your metric for goodness?
We thought so.
Okay.
They're the best ones the best ones we could find.
I mean, why when you're doing anthropology did you study the Zulu tribe or whatever? Because that's what you did. So if you think we did a poor job picking, pick your own.
Okay, so the yardstick is intended to be good organizations,
yeah,
as opposed to a random or poor,
yeah,
which might be interesting,
yeah,
to find dysfunctional things we should not...
And we're getting some poor ones now, and we're like, gosh, this yardstick is mighty tall. It doesn't have small enough thingies. Yeah.
But before you have a scale to put things on, it's hard to say, you know, well, which are the heaviest items, right?
Sorry to be glib. But...
Will?
Did any of the observations of the 110 activities map into groups other than the SSG? For example,
yes.
Are
yes.
there questions about common frameworks that that developers use?
Yes, there are, and yes, they do. And sometimes the satellite was involved in those, which we alluded to earlier in the talk. But here is an observation that held across the board that we haven't really published yet. That is, in the beginning of a software security initiative, it seems to be people centralize and they put all the authority and responsibility in one location. And as an initiative matures, the responsibility spreads out throughout the entire organization. And a more mature software security initiative seems to be correlated with a more distributed software security initiative.
I'll give you two more examples here. At the lowest level of security testing, it's not even necessarily about security yet. It's about doing some rigorous software testing, which is carried out by the testing organization.
Yeah, like do you do boundary conditions and edge conditions?
In the deployment set, we have kind of, before you're ready to talk about software security, you need to not entirely suck at operational security. And that's the ops guys. So we touch on a couple of different parts of that organization.
Good question.
Which actually leads me to a second question. I want to catch up.
You let him do it. Your call.
Sorry.
You got it.
All right. Thank you. since you're up to 17 organizations, are there any plans to break the data set out based on organizational nuances, such as development groups that only have four or organizations that only have 400 developers tend to do these things versus organizations that have 30,000 developers tend to do these other things?
When we can do it in a smart and meaningful way, yes.
Maybe. I mean, the problem with this work now from a science perspective is we're describing 9 vectors. And it's important data, but it's only 9, so we can't say anything with confidence about groups over the 9. We could do a little bit. There's one statistical method we could apply. But it's not a very interesting one. In the future, we expect to be able to do that. But you're talking about the way future, because then we'll have to have at least 30 data points in each, 30 vectors in each of the domains in order to have statistical, a reasonable sample in each domain. We aspire to that. If you want to help us, let us know.
I think one thing that would be really interesting, I'm not sure if it's in your report because I haven't read it yet, but the activities that you did not observe, which maybe yeah, as you're doing this comparison, as you're calling it religion and then what's actually in practice, and you won't be making calls on it, but it would be nice to see a Venn diagram between here are all the techniques and methods that have been advocated, and this is what we observed, and see what those intersections would be. That might be very interesting.
That is being captured in the data, actually, because now that we have the 110 activities that were observed over this collective 9, then we can go to other organizations,
exactly,
and see whether they're not doing any of the things and how uncommon some of those things in the model
are.
It'd
just be nice to have that juxtaposition of,
yeah,
here are the things that are advocated in all these different methods and whatever, and then these are the only things that we observe.
Yeah,
so
sort of
here
an
are
anti
the things that just are not being done, you decide why.
So what was Martin Luther's thing called the 12 theses that we can nail on the church door? We need to come up with those. Good idea.
So you know, a related idea that Adam Shostak had is that we might be able to ask people about things that they stopped doing. That maybe that was for some evolution of an organization, something made sense, and then later on it stopped making sense.
Because it would be really nice to just get out the things that people have said for a long time you should do, and then say, but nobody's doing them.
Right.
And if you have those anecdotes for why, that
well,
would be really
believe
valuable.
It or not, that was the very genesis of this project. Because we saw a model that looked incredibly cool, and it looked great if you lived in a closet, right? And having been out in the trenches for a long time, I said, you know what? I've just never seen that. So let's do it the other way. Let's let the data drive it. Nobody's lined up. I think we're done.